is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The severity in terms of the amount of oxygen that's needed, the number of patients that are requiring ventilation is a lot lower than what we've seen in other waves.
That's Dr. Michelle Groom of South Africa's National Institute of Communicable Diseases on signs that the Omicron variant of COVID-19 is less deadly than earlier strains. Details coming up. Also, U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, will be in Ethiopia's capital Addis Ababa tomorrow. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Medical authorities in South Africa say the Christmas and New Year holiday period has so far done little to increase the severity of the country's fourth wave of COVID-19 driven by the Omicron variant. Up until recently, South Africa has been the epicenter of the Omicron outbreak. Local scientists were the first to detect it in November. The highly infectious variant now is causing health emergencies around the world. Darren Taylor reports.
Previous vacation periods have resulted in dramatic spikes in COVID-19 infections, hospitalizations, and deaths as millions of people traveled and interacted around South Africa. This time around, that's not happening.
The severity in terms of the amount of oxygen that's needed, the number of patients that are requiring ventilation is a lot lower than what we've seen in other waves.
Dr. Michelle Groom is head of public health surveillance and response at South Africa's National Institute for Communicable Diseases.
We know that over the holiday periods, there are slightly lower testing numbers, but I think the positivity rates have been steadily decreasing in all of the provinces. And so I think that's quite a good indicator that we're on the downward slope of this fourth wave. If it was just that people weren't accessing testing, we would still expect the positivity rates to be very high. But I think the positivity rates definitely are coming down at the moment. So I think that's a very positive sign.
One of South Africa's leading infectious diseases specialists, Fitz University's Professor Shabir Madi, estimates up to 40% of the population of 60 million have contracted Omicron. But he adds counting numbers of infections is academic.
Our focus really needs to be on hospitalization and death. The most important is that there's been a complete uncoupling of the cases and hospitalization rate and death.
In the South African context, says Madi, Omicron's not sending many people to hospital and is causing far fewer deaths.
This time last year, we were looking at least two to three times greater number of hospitalizations taking place. And the number of people that were dying of COVID-19, including as an example during the course of the Delta wave, which was our third wave, was about 10 times greater than the number of people that have been dying of COVID-19 during the course of this particular wave.
Groom says it's possible deaths will drop even further in coming months.
This lower level of deaths compared to what we've seen previously, I think, is really encouraging. And I think we can get those deaths even lower if we can just, you know, get more people to vaccinate. Booster vaccinations are now available, and especially for those who just got the one dose of Johnson & Johnson. I think definitely to get the second dose of Johnson & Johnson as soon as possible. And obviously those with Pfizer, you know, when they're eligible to have their booster dose as well. And for those who haven't vaccinated, because we know that vaccination and prior infection are going to really protect against the severe disease outcomes like hospitalization and death.
Mardi says reasons for the apparent mildness of disease that Omicron's causing in South Africa include extensive immunity in the population, both because of vaccination and infections during the first three waves.
I do believe that the high percentage of the population have been infected with Omicron, much greater than the number of cases that have been recorded. So there's immunity that's also evolving against Omicron, which will protect against infection due to Omicron because of people having been infected.
Groom urges people not to become blasé because Omicron's less severe in South Africa and not to rely on natural immunity to protect them against severe disease. Rely on vaccines is her message. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has published part one of a report from Acting Chief Justice Raymond Zondo, who chaired the Commission of Inquiry into State Capture and Corruption in South Africa. The report is damning of former President Jacob Zuma and recommends prosecution of some officials and state-owned enterprises. Tusokumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The 874-page report accuses Zuma of fleeing the commission because he could not explain some of the decisions he made. It also labeled some of his testimony as dishonest. Ramaphosa published the report on the president's website soon after receiving it yesterday. The report reveals stinking rot from corruption in state-owned enterprises. It found that Dudumnyeni, appointed by former President Zuma to chair the board of the South African Airways, acted with neglect, incompetence, and corrupt intentions to dismantle good governance procedures at the Prastatal. This, according to the report, was done to create an environment where corruption would thrive. Brian Molefe, appointed by Zuma to lead the power utility Eskom, was found to have allowed irregular and wasteful contracts that enabled companies owned by the Gupta brothers to pocket millions of dollars through corrupt tenders. Former Commissioner of the South African Revenue Authority, Tom Moyane, and Zuma are accused of working hand in glove to deliberately weaken the once renowned tax authority to open doors for looting. President Cyril Ramaphosa has assured the nation that he will pay close attention to the report's recommendations.
They will be implemented, and we take this work of the Zondo Commission very, very seriously to end state capture.
But Democratic Alliance Party leader John Steenhuisen was doubtful.
I think the momentous moment will come when we start to see the first convictions, the first imprisonments, the first civil recoveries, and the first sackings.
The ruling African National Congress did not escape unscathed. Zondo produced a paper trail showing how the ruling party was on two occasions funded by companies that were granted corrupt tenders by ANC representatives in positions of power. Political analyst Sandy Leswana told the media that this was not surprising.
A lot of the time, this state capture was also for the benefit of senior cadres in the African National Congress and the African National Congress itself.
Judge Zondo recommends that legal action be taken against those found to have broken the law. Zondo said part 2 and 3 of the report will be delivered in the coming months. Tusokumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, Ned Price, confirmed yesterday that U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, will be in Addis Ababa tomorrow to discuss prospects for peace with senior Ethiopian officials. According to this spokesperson, the U.S. seeks an immediate halt of hostilities, an end to human rights abuses and violations, unhindered humanitarian access, and a negotiated resolution to the conflict in Ethiopia, saying it threatens peace and security in the Horn of Africa. Meanwhile, the Associated Press, quoting Human Rights Watch report, says officials in Ethiopia have arbitrarily detained and forcibly disappeared thousands of ethnic Tigrayans who recently were deported from Saudi Arabia. Thousands of Ethiopians from the country's Tigray and Amhara regions illegally travel each year to Saudi Arabia through Yemen in search of a better life. The Ethiopian government, according to the Wire report, says it is only targeting individuals suspected of supporting the Tigray forces who have fought the government since November 2020 but pulled back into their region weeks ago. Also, on Ethiopia, the United Nations Emergency Response Agency today said more than 6 million people in areas of eastern and southern Ethiopia hit by drought will need life-saving assistance this year. Tunisian President Kais Saied appears to be sticking to his guns by announcing that he will keep the parliament shut, appoint a committee to revise the constitution, and postpone elections until December 17th. The response of the international community to Saied's increasingly authoritarian rule has been relatively mild. The United States joined Canada, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the European Union in affirming the commitment to help Tunisia maintain its democratic experiment. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy discussed the mild international response with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington.
At the Summit of Democracy in early December, the U.S. did exclude Tunisia from among the 110 countries that it invited that were considered either democracies or partial democracies progressing in the right direction in some important way. But the U.S. also excluded democratic civil society from Tunisia. The U.S. statements from the White House have been weak, from the State Department weaker, and from the U.S. Embassy in Tunisia under Ambassador Blom, the weakest. There are two plausible explanations given to me by people who know Ambassador Blom well and have worked directly with him. First, the leading explanation is that he's just trying to curry enough favor with the president and prime minister of Tunisia that he can get access in order to privately pressure them. So he's using the public statements in order to gain access and curry favor. But that's not necessarily good diplomatic praxis when everyone's watching what the U.S. is saying. The secondary explanation is that the U.S. has made some sort of calculation that Tunisia matters less than everywhere else, and we're going to put our attention elsewhere. Again, seeing that what the White House has been saying in the previous statements in the summer and early fall, I don't really believe this is the case. I think it's been more just a failure of making statements that take full account of the situation. There are two big constraints on what the international community can say. One is that Saied was democratically elected in a landslide. And number two, after the coup, he had polling results as high as 87%. Another constraint is what's called a Nahda. A Nahda syndrome says that while everyone's opposing Kais Saied, they don't want to join the largest political party, Nahda, in opposing Saied because the former Islamist party is seen as toxic. But Saied himself has a radical, autocratic political position that believes in one-man rule, giving all the powers of government to the executive with very little in the way of judicial or parliamentary checks and balances, both before his upcoming constitutional changes and after. And so he's also calling all political opponents traitors, devils, viruses, and microbes. And he's arresting whomever he wants, most recently the vice president of the largest party in parliament. So all of this is political theater. It's lies, it's pretext, and terrible for the future of Tunisian democracy because Tunisian people have real grievances, real socioeconomic grievances. And what Saied did is instead of addressing the socioeconomic grievances, he took away their political rights. So he hijacked the grievances in order to enact his version of one-man rule.
So what's preventing Saied's opponents from solidifying as a wide coalition and to find some common ground on the difficult challenges of economic reform and unifying behind a realistic roadmap that points the way to a new democratic bargain?
In Tunisia, to do anything big, you need the largest labor union, UGTT, which was instrumental in the revolution, and you need Nahda party, which is the largest political party, both acting together. In this case, they're not. Nahda is opposing the coup and UGTT has been generally supporting the coup, just criticizing it for being too politically oriented and not economically oriented. But what's preventing them is the inability to coalesce around a common program. There's also a big divide and conquer strategy paid for by foreign interests who are stirring up social media to create divisions among Tunisians with tens of thousands of foreign accounts producing, you know, fake news and division like happened in the U.S. elections. But until we have enough opposition to Saied because of his actions, we'll have thousands in the street rather than 100,000 in the street. It won't be until UGTT tells its members to join the protests that we'll have those large numbers. Now, COVID has been a factor. The economic downturn has been a factor. And there's a huge disagreement in Tunisia over the economic program. Sometimes we joke that the 1970s is arguing with the 1980s when it comes to Tunisian economics, meaning socialist top-down solutions, which tend tend to be economy killers, or, you know, wide open liberalization like the 1980s, which tend to be aggravators of inequality and destabilizing, you know, crony capitalism and all that. But a 21st century economics of Tunisia is being presented by none of the political parties. So we have strong companies in Tunisia and robust entrepreneurial sector, but no political party is really advancing that interest. But the debate right now isn't even over economics. It's over the roadmap and how to get back to constitutional democracy. And on that, we have growing consensus among the political parties. And I expect, again, with this growing opposition to Said, we'll see more people in the street and more cooperation among the political parties.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at American University in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, some of the people displaced by the recent volcanic eruption are still living in camps. In the Kayembe site, not far from the city of Goma, some are living in difficult conditions because of the dilapidated state of their small houses. Reporter Zanim Neti Zaid has the details.
At the Kayembe internally displaced persons camp in Nyiragongo territory, north of Goma city, residents are having a difficult time. Camp resident Sekanabo shows us her hut made of old tarpaulins, which leaks during the heavy rains, a situation that no longer allows her to sleep easily. She says when it rains, the water invades their huts. Because of the dilapidated tarpaulins, there are big drops that come out of the top. When this happens, she and her children have to stay still, doing nothing. And then the next day, they take their wet sink and dry them in the sun. Feza also struggles with a leaking tarpaulin roof. She tells me that when it rains, her hut is flooded with water. Faced with this situation, her family is forced to sleep standing up every time there is bad weather. More than 30 people died and thousands lost their homes on the outskirts of the city of Goma last May when the Mount Nyiragongo volcano erupted. The eruption of the volcano, which is about 12 kilometers from Goma, forced thousands of people into displacement camps, and 7 months later, hundreds remain. Camp residents say the poorer conditions have not led to more help from the government or humanitarian organizations. Fazila Kabuya, a spokesperson for the displaced, appeals for help. Kabuya says the displaced suffer in this camp. When it rains, their houses are flooded with water and that they have no assistance. She asks the authorities to help them by giving them new taps. Camp officials say hundreds of displaced people have experienced these conditions since the camp was opened.
People living in Zimbabwe have long argued that the country may have many problems such as a frail economy, high inflation and low employment, but security has not been among them, at least until a recent surge in gun crimes and robberies. Kuzeza Nawashi has more on the story.
Entrepreneur Jeffrey Ncube is a victim of these rising gun crimes. He recalls the incident at his family home in Harare.
I heard a gunshot at my place around 1:15 a.m. In the morning. So we thought it was an electric fault. So when I woke up, I realized that it was a gunshot. There were some robbers at my place, and they almost killed my little brother. Then when we asked him what happened, then the person then told us that they were armed robbers. They were threatening that they want to kill him. He ran away. Then he just took a phone and a bag, the one we used to keep our money, but these days we're no longer keeping our money in that bag.
Assistant Commissioner Paul Nyati is the National Zimbabwe Republic Police spokesperson.
Over the Christmas period, we said we'd arrested from January to October, we'd arrested a total of 849 armed robbery suspects. And the president had filed 5 high-powered vehicles to CID homicide to take armed robbery case in the country in a few of. Besides the other 130 vehicles which we have held, we have been making arrests on a weekly basis of armed robbers. And we have said we are on top of the situation and there's no going back on the fight against the armed robbery suspects. And we've had shootouts where some of our officers have died. We've had shootouts where some of the robbery suspects have died. So the war is on.
The numbers have become so worrying, and suspects have included trained security personnel, both active and retired. This prompted a warning from President Emmerson Mnangagwa during his Unity Day speech in December.
Government now treats this as a grave threat to personal and national security. Decisive measures have now become necessary to put an end to this growing menace, which threatens our otherwise peaceful, law-abiding nation and citizenry. Those who dabble in arms will soon fall by the sword. Let them be warned.
Nyati explains some of the factors behind the surge.
People are keeping large sums of money at home. People are keeping large sums of money at business premises. And the information is leaking from the workers to family members to friends, where we have said people should not share information on their financial status with each and every person. And we've also said some security guards, which are contracted to carry money, they are stage managing robbery cases.
In the past, guns have not been within reach of many, but police say there have been cases of security guards being disarmed while on duty and their guns stolen. Households and businesses being robbed and guns stolen. Some guns have been intercepted by authorities being smuggled into the country. Former deputy minister under the Mugabe regime, Godfrey Gandawa, is quoted in the local media saying the guns being used are the same guns which were taken from the police and intelligence officers during the 2017 coup. He says the soldiers who disarmed these operatives did not take the guns back to the armory and there was no accountability. Ncube says police should consider extensive patrols at night in residential areas. He says victims remain scarred forever and have to learn to live in fear. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Gihayus Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music
from Bobo music to Hip Life, Bonga flavor to Sukus, Afrobeat to Ndombolo and Makosa to Kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05.